This is an ABC podcast.
I wanted to make a beautiful piece of art that was a multiple and that I could bring back to the community and leave with them, and where they could see themselves represented and in connection with other communities of the Americas that are going through similar processes.
We live in a world with changing waterways, rivers going up and rivers going down, and sometimes lives upended. I'm Daniel Browning. Welcome to The Art Show here on Radio National. Coming to you today from Gadigal land, where the 23rd Biennale of Sydney, Rivas, is taking place. You'll soon meet a fascinating Colombian artist making portraits of water. I'll also take you inside the studio of Dennis Golding, enshrining memories of his Redfern childhood into transcendent emblems of light and shade.
There's something so beautiful but so powerful about that memory as well, that you put this object on and all of a sudden you change and you transform and you become something else.
And what happens when the notoriously fickle art world turns its back on cashed-up Russian oligarchs?
One of the key things about being a rich person right now is buying contemporary art. That is, you know, just as much as having your yacht or your plane, you have to have, you know, your Jeff Koons.
That's all coming up here on The Art Show. The pounding of water of a river dam, one of more than 250 large hydroelectric power stations in Latin America. Now dams form a huge part of energy production in that part of the world. But they also come with consequences. Environmental, as you can imagine, and social. And if you're in Australia and think this sounds like a faraway concern, remember that Australia's BHP Billiton co-owned the Mariana mining dam in Brazil. When that flooded, it was called Brazil's biggest ever environmental disaster. Carolina Caicedo is a UK-born Colombian artist whose work is intimately connected with the realities of dams, both on the rivers that they disrupt, like Colombia's Magdalena River, and the lives of indigenous communities who live alongside it. And she's part of Rivas, this year's Sydney Biennale. Hi, Carolina. Welcome to The Art Show.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Now, when you walk into the exhibition space to see your work at the Sydney Biennale, you're faced with a piece of flowing fabric with a river photographically printed over it. It's a portrait of water, essentially. What's behind these portraits?
It's a series that I started a few years ago as a way to consolidate a relationship that I developed with a particular river or a particular part of the river, understanding that the format of landscape as we know it has been complicit in colonial processes and even in building the colonial gaze, also complicit in putting humans outside of the set of relationships that conform an ecosystem. Because if you think about the format of a landscape, it's like a window through which we look at nature, but we're not inside it, right?
Immersion over dominion. I mean, I guess landscape painting, just the viewpoint that you're given is one of an observer and looking over and having some kind of dominion over the landscape. Whereas there is another way to look at it, and this is the way Indigenous people throughout the world, you know, encounter and understand their river systems. It's one of immersion. Now, some great rivers in the world have been granted the rights of personhood. They are living entities. In New Zealand, in the Ganges, for example, and the Atrato, I think, in Colombia, in your home country. How does this fit into the traditional First Nations understanding of rivers, do you think, this idea of personhood?
Well, in different communities that you know I've approached and learned from, the river takes different kind of roles within the set of relationships. For example, the Amazon is a dad, like a father, is masculine, while the Xingu River in Brazil for people is a mãe, a mother, right? So they even have genders, if you wish, or more than one gender. Sometimes the rivers stand actually for entities that are larger than our comprehension, like a cobra grande, the big snake in Amazonian epistemologies. you know, which is the snake that kind of carves its ways through the land. And it's what makes the riverbeds and all, it's like the river arms too and channels. For other peoples, it's a grandfather or a sister or a brother. And, you know, it has to do with the understanding that rivers are like us. You know, they have the ability and the agency to change the course of events. So in that sense, they're a political subject.
And there's beautiful resonances with First Nations communities here. We talk about, you know, the waterway having been carved by a giant serpent in some cases, a rainbow. The rainbow serpent, we call him this kind of deity, all-consuming, all-pervasive character in our cosmologies. But which indigenous communities do you work with in Brazil and Colombia? And how has that relationship been nurtured and started?
Well, I wouldn't say that I work with them. I've been more like a student. And I've had the chance to be close at certain moments. So I wouldn't, you know, claim that it's a constant work or collaboration, but really, really part of my kind of self-education, right? And we have amazing indigenous scholars in Latin America, you know, from Brazil, I can mention Ailton Krenak, for example, or Kopenawa. Or I've had the chance to speak with some elders from communities of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, from the Kogi community, Mamo Pedro Juan, who has passed since I had the chance to share time with him. Most recently, I've worked closely with a chairman of a tribe in Texas, the Carrizo Come Crudo tribe, that is not recognized federally or by the state of Texas, but that have, as a tribe, been defending their tribal identity and also spearheading environmental justice in the region by stopping the construction of the border wall, by, you know, protesting against the establishment of different industries, such as oil industries, and now the conquest of space, you know, with establishment of all these labs that are shooting rockets, you know, all these millionaires in Texas. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's been more a process of learning and approaching and doing a lot of self-education. And when I have the chance to spend some time really, you know, taking that, embracing that.
Now, when did you first become concerned with the Magdalena or Yuma River?
That was in the early 2010s when I learned that they were diverting the river to build a hydroelectric dam. And it was important because this was the first transnational dam built in Colombia. It was actually a multi-purpose dam, so also serving as a water reservoir and also as a tourist attraction. So they started building the dam and they wanted to divert the river. And in a kind of independent media source, I read an article that referred to the river in first person, saying the river doesn't allow for its diversion. And that really caught my eye. Again, it was the first time I, you know, encountered the river being referred as an entity in first person, you know, with agency. And that was the entry point. And then, and that took me to visit the place, to meet people, to share time with people there. But it kind of touched personal history because when I was a teenager, my dad was growing cotton crops, and we lived on the riverbanks of the Magdalena, not precisely where El Quimbo is being constructed, further down, in a town called Girardot. So, you know, for me, what I remember of the river was this kind of unmovable body of water. And suddenly to learn that they were drying the riverbed to divert it, was really, you know, blew my mind. And that was the entry point. Then I visited for the first time in 2012. And since then, I keep on returning. I feel like the river called me back to Colombia in a way. So I kind of just followed that call.
Tell me about your work with the Colombian water rights group. They're called Rios Vivos. Do you define yourself as an activist in the traditional sense? A lot of your work is so concerned with environmental justice.
I don't identify as an activist. Activists in my country get killed, and environmentalists most, you know, social leaders, human rights defenders get killed. And so I'm nowhere close of being on the front line like those folks. I do consider I participate of processes of defense, defense and protection of water and land through my art making. So in a way, visual activism would be maybe, you know, I would be more comfortable with that. But also because, you know, it's taken as a woman of color quite a time and a lot of hard work to be respected just as an artist, no? And I'm also not comfortable with the word activist because I think it takes agency from all of us, right? Like you can't do anything if you're not an activist, which is not true. We all have the power in our hands to change things from any discipline, you know, we practice, journalism, art making, if you're in the front lines or not, we all could kind of have an activist role in our society. And I'm skipping the second part of the question.
I wanted to know about Rios Vivos.
Oh, Rios Vivos. Yeah. When I started visiting El Quimbo Dam, there was already a strong political organization on the ground, grassroots organization on the ground, opposing the dam. And they were articulated to a national organization, social movement called Rios Vivos, which means living rivers. So living rivers, Rios Vivos, is an agglutination of different organizations, regional organizations, you know, opposing dams in their territories. The particular organization at that moment in Huila, where El Quimbo was being constructed, was called Aso Quimbo. And I've been more a supporter of their agendas, you know, kind of participating through facilitating workshops, facilitating actions, or sometimes inviting them into artistic spaces, kind of more institutional spaces also, to open up dialogues and discourses and critical thinking about progress, ideas of progress, ideas of development, ideas of energetic transition, you know, in artistic or cultural institutions, which I believe, you know, are spaces where we need to debate these issues, right? So it's been, I consider myself more like an ally of the social movement. Through Rios Vivos, I've had the chance to also become an ally of the movement of people affected by dams in Brazil, MABI, and MABDER in Mexico. And then all these organizations are actually constituted in a regional organization in Latin America called MAR, Movimiento de Afectados por Represas, Movement of People Affected by Dams.
Now, the work at the Biennale of Sydney, Be Damned, is an ongoing project for you. Can you take me through its different forms? It's had different iterations.
Yes, like a different series conformed this body of work. I use different mediums to kind of unfold some of the ideas, you know, and some of the critiques I want to highlight through the work. So I use film, artist books, large murals made of satellite imagery, these water portraits that take shape in these long printed fabrics, or sometimes films themselves. Performance is an important part of the body of work, as well as community events and what I call geo-choreographies, which are a series of performatic direct actions that happen in the territory close to the river with the communities. However, I don't have any intention or any interest in translating these more community-led collaborations into the White Cube. So it kind of, there's two parallel kind of practices there. One that's kind of with and by and for the community, and then the other that happens in the studio and kind of is a reflection of all those stuff that I learn when I'm doing field work or what I consider spiritual field work. And that's what you will see in the biennial. And for me, it's important, you know, I think my work kind of is a, you think a bit about it as a constellation, right? Where each work kind of shines on its own and can be seen on its own, or, you know, you're going to be lucky and see a constellation of them in the biennial that, you know, when you see them together, you will see the overlaps. You will see sometimes how even titles are shared between the works. And I think about it as an open-ended body of work, right, that continues to unfold, that continues to be braided, that continues to ground itself in different territories. And most importantly, at this moment, connect different stories of struggle across the Americas that are, you know, communities who are defending water.
Sete quedas por mim passaram, e todas sete se esvaíram. Cessa o estrondo das cachoeiras, e com ele a memória dos índios, pulverizada, já não desperta o mínimo arrepio.
Now, you use many different mediums, as you've explained, including the form of the book. The Serpent River book unfolds along a table. How do we read the Serpent River book?
You can enter it at any point, the same that you enter a river. So it's up to you, really. I propose a narrative, and the Serpent River book has a source and a delta. You're welcome to read it that way, and that's how it's installed in its more sculptural way in the biennial. And you know, I kind of the chapters of the book, if you wish. And what you will see actually in Sydney is the upper part of this accordion or concertina fold, which is mostly visual. If you had actually the possibility of picking up the book and leafing through it, you will encounter a more textual collection, but that's kind of on the lower side, what's against the table in the installation. But what you will see in Sydney is the upper part that's very visual, and that we have some chapters that correspond to the parts of a river. So a source, an upper body, a middle body, a lower body, and the delta. And each of these bodies are representing a different perspective over the river, right? So it starts with a very Amazonian epistemology, precisely talking about a cobra grande, the big snake. And then it passes on to a more peasant perspective that is rooted still in indigenous embodied knowledge. Then it passes into a more extractivist perspective, and you start seeing the building of dams. Then what happens when this perspective collapses, which is actually where I think we are at the moment, right? We are at the collapsing of this model, this capitalistic extractive model. And then the last part before the delta, the lower body, is the creative and hopeful reaction and proposals that the communities who are in resistance are providing us with. So you can enter at any point, and you can go upstream or you can go downstream.
What's the significance then of conveying, you know, the information of the work and the knowledge, the experience, I guess, or the immersion in a river? What's the significance then of a book?
Yeah, well, for me personally, it was a way to revise my archive and all the information that you collect and that not necessarily is visible in the other works, right? In the Cosmoatarrayas or in the performances or, you know, or in the mural that you will see. So it was a way to kind of present this information, but I wanted to present it in a way that instead of closing the project, would open it up, right? And would open possibilities of interpretation. And, you know, I think about this book as the first of a number of publications. Wow, now that I think, you know, it's a self-published book in 2017. It's already five years, right? I need to get going with the next one. But as any other river, you know, I envision it as a body of water that will connect to other bodies of water. So I envision actually other publications being able to connect in the future with this one. And I wanted to make also a work of art that I could bring back the community to the communities that I've collaborated with and that have taught me so much. Because normally as artists, sometimes we replicate extractivist processes, right? Indeed. By going into a community and taking images, taking information, taking testimonies. And what do we leave, right? Because a lot of these communities don't have access to the Sydney Biennial or can't go to the main city, to the museum to see the work. And so I wanted to make a beautiful piece of art that was a multiple and that I could bring back to the community and leave with them, and where they could see themselves represented and in connection with other communities of the Americas that are going through similar processes.
I was actually surprised to learn that the United States is one of the leading countries in terms of dam removal, and that, of course, allows for the restoration of river ecosystems. Do you see the change that's happening there, perhaps, kind of flowing to parts of Latin America where this is such an issue, the rights and sovereignty of water?
Not as much as I would like to, and I feel that is something that, you know, I dream with, like to bring and to bridge these communities in a stronger way. No, I mean, there in some communities in Latin America, there is an awareness that undamming is happening in the United States, but there's not enough strong connections, right? We're still dealing in Latin America with opposing more dam construction. And even here in the States, actually, there's still some dams, you know, and in Canada that are being proposed. But, you know, I think even worldwide, there's already, you know, like there has been a shift in the imaginary of what a dam represents, which until a number of years ago, it was a feat of engineering. It was related or, you know, associated with clean and green energy. You know, it was considered, you know, water was considered a renewable resource, which now we know it's not true, you know, that actually water disappears and there's droughts and that bodies of water shrink. So I think there has been, you know, all this undamming and dam decommissioning happening in the States, along other sorts of activism, like, you know, granting legal rights to bodies of water, has started to shift, a very necessary shift in the way that we think about progress, infrastructure, but also because we've seen this infrastructure age, right? And we have very old infrastructure here in the States and, you know, all across the global north. And we've seen this infrastructure start to collapse, to deteriorate, to not produce as much as electricity as it's supposed to because it's sedimented. So I think it's been important, not only in Latin America, but in, you know, worldwide view, to start shifting this idea that dams and hydroelectricity are 100% clean energy.
Carolina, it's been such a pleasure to have you on The Art Show. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
Carolina Caicedo, and her work is showing as part of the Sydney Biennale, which runs until the 22nd of June. Find links on The Art Show website or at biennaleofsydney.art. This is The Art Show on Radio National. You're with me, Daniel Browning. Russia's invasion of neighbouring Ukraine continues to inflict horrific casualties, not to mention displacement and loss, including of cultural spaces. Just last week, you might have read of the bombing of the drama theatre in Mariupol and the women and children sheltering inside it. And in the past few days, an art school on Mariupol's left bank was targeted by Russian fighter jets, where 400 people had sought refuge. It was completely destroyed, according to city officials, messaging on Telegram. When it comes to the world of high-end art and the oligarch class who invest in it, some repercussions of Putin's war are being felt in Moscow. Le Garage is the city's museum of contemporary art and was until recently a prestigious public-facing gallery, founded by its curator Dasha Zhukova in 2008 and her then-husband, Roman Abramovich. But big-name international artists are fast pulling out, and their peers are demanding unequivocal anti-war statements from the management of Le Garage. Nate Freeman is the art columnist for Vanity Fair magazine, who's covered the impact of the war on Russia's art world. We spoke to him from New York. Hi, Nate. Welcome to The Art Show.
Great to be here.
Tell me, how important is this museum in Russia's art landscape?
I think that it's incredibly important. Dasha's goal, alongside her then-husband Roman, was to build a contemporary art center that could stand up with the great contemporary art concerns in the world, whether that's you know, the ICA London or the New Museum in New York. They really wanted it to be a standout institution that could showcase the most celebrated, exciting, avant-garde contemporary artists. And to a large extent, that was the case. She commissioned a stunning building from the architect Rem Koolhaas, one of the most celebrated starchitects around. The opening party in 2015, which I was in attendance for, was really a knockout affair. Besides all the partying and fancy meals, just the staggering number of artists who made the trek out to Moscow was really incredible. Not just artists, also curators, museum directors, patrons of the arts, collectors. Taking all that into account, you know, she was quite successful in building the garage into a institution that was known around the world and had become a stop on this sort of art world hajj that you know, collectors, curators, artists go on. Her father was a sort of mini garch, not one of these, like, you know, all powerful $30 billion worth oligarchs, but he was connected to the government, you know, got in on some oil deals, made a decent amount of money. Her parents got divorced. She grew up actually in Los Angeles. And so, you know, though she was very rooted in Moscow and Moscow society, she, you know, didn't really grow up in it. Eventually she started working in magazines. And when she met Roman, and they got married in 2008, that was when she really started to dive into the contemporary art world. And, you know, when they opened the first iteration of Garage, it was her way of saying, I am a major player on the scene. Even if she won't necessarily show her private collection at the Garage is mostly for, you know, exhibitions, you know, that artists were invited to do.
We know that Russian theatre and other art forms have faced increased censorship over portraying themes that are considered to be antithetical to the state, like stories with LGBTQI characters. But is it different in the visual art world? Is there more freedom?
I think that to a large extent, it did have freedoms that other media theatre might not have had. That being said, it couldn't get away with some things that other institutions could get away with, whether that be overtly political work or overtly sexual work in nature. At the same time, you know, even recently, Le Garage was described to me as a sort of bastion of the avant-garde. It was a place where, in an increasingly sterile and cracked down city like Moscow, young people who are interested in contemporary art could go and, you know, peruse the library, which was enormous and very well stocked. They could go to the cafe and meet like-minded Muscovites. It was really a as liberal and open of a community as you could come across. Yes, there was, you know, some level of censorship, and I'm sure there was hesitation to have any overtly political work on, you know, prominent display. But at the same time, you know, in a city where dissent and you know, political outspokenness is not just not celebrated, but cracked down upon to an extent that people get arrested or even imprisoned for, this was a place where people felt comfortable speaking their mind, reading books that, you know, they might not have access to elsewhere, and seeing contemporary art.
Well, if owning contemporary art is just part of being an ultra-rich person in Russia, what kind of work was shown at Le Garage? Was it more avant-garde?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was talking about the sort of public in Moscow who were allowed to, you know, experience their version, a Russian version of what a, you know, open-minded contemporary art museum would be. When it comes to the oligarchs, yes, they sort of live in this bubble where they benefit immensely from the authoritarian nature of the government that that essentially made them billionaires, because all oligarchs, you know, they reached a level of prominency and wealth due to, you know, the proximity to Putin and other government officials. But, you know, they don't live their lives like that. They live their lives like billionaires. They have yachts, they have homes in Miami and London and New York. They jet sit around the world on private jets. They enjoy the high life. And one of the key things about being a rich person right now is buying contemporary art. That is, you know, just as much as having your yacht or your plane, you have to have, you know, your Jeff Koons. And the oligarchs started to understand that, you know, around 2005, 2006. By 2008, Larry Gagosian had opened a gallery there in Moscow in Red October, selling directly to the oligarchs. They thought that owning contemporary art, even if they didn't fully get it or love it, just owning contemporary art was part of being a rich person.
What happened to the museum after the invasion, that statement they made that didn't go down so well with the art world?
Well, the statement that the Garage put out, and this was, from what I understand through reporting, put out by curators at the museum under pressure by the artists who were scheduled to show. It was a statement that did not make clear that they were against a war. They didn't say that they were against Putin. It was a sort of more vague kind of explanation as to why programming had been paused. And, you know, it's been noted that many people who have posted on social media against the war, saying explicitly, you know, that you know, this is Putin's responsibility, they've been jailed or reprimanded in various ways. And I understand how dangerous it is right now, how the landscape makes it impossible to, you know, use your voice freely. But at the same time, a lot of people in the art world just did not think the statement was forceful enough against Putin, against the war, and they thought it sounded a little wishy-washy. The one person that I cited was the curator Allison Gingeris, who is a major force in the art world. She used to advise and curate shows for Francois Pino, the billionaire collector, who has private museums in both Paris and Venice. And so that sort of like snowballed a little bit into this movement against Garage. And so that's what's happened since then. In addition to that, a lot of employees for the museum, curators on down, have left Moscow, from my understanding. It's starting to seem like a city that you can't truly exist in if you are a, you know, culturally minded upper middle class or even just middle classes. And so I think that a lot of people are just giving up on the idea that Moscow will be in any way open at any time soon. So you're seeing a lot of brain drain from the arts community in Moscow, including Garage, and you're still seeing a backlash against it from you know, other people in the art community who think that it needs to be stronger against Putin.
Thanks, Nate. And that's Nate Freeman, art columnist at Vanity Fair magazine. Find links on the Art Show website. Daniel Browning with you for The Art Show here on Radio National. Well, I reckon that emerging artists need signatures. And I don't mean their handwriting. I mean things that identify them. Think of Warhol's iconic soup cans or his Brillo boxes at the very start of his career. Well, Dennis Golding is a Gamilaroi man who grew up on Gadigal land in the inner Sydney suburb of Redfern, the politically conscious black capital, where the first Aboriginal health and legal services and the National Black Theatre were established in the 1970s. When Dennis was a little fella, he idolised Batman. And the superhero became a personal totem, a signature, if you like, expressing his own sense of empowerment. And in his art practice, he's assumed the mantle of the Caped Crusader. There's one image I'm thinking of, and it's him surveying hulking container ships as they prepare to unload their cargo of imported goods at Botany Bay. And there's a silky cape fluttering in the wind behind him. Well, Dennis's latest signature is Iron Lace. It once trimmed the balconies and landings of Redfern's now vanished terrace houses, lost to gentrification. I'm with Dennis Golding in his studio in the former Everleigh Rail Yards. barely a hop, skip and a jump from Redfern.
Growing up in Redfern was a really great time for me, learning about my culture, learning about identity as well, but understanding why many Aboriginal families lived on this in this community. It's something I always seen as well growing up, that there were great memories and great things to take away from the block, but there was poverty around the community as well. We went to Darlington Public School, just up the road here from Carriage Works where we are, and it was a community hub for us. You know, we celebrated songs, we celebrated culture every NAIDOC. We'd dress up and, you know, be proud wearing red, black and yellow at school. But a lot of those events also happened down in the block, in the paddocks as well, where many, you know, well-known sports people came down to the block to, you know, work, you know, with youth. And it was so good just seeing these heroes, people who we've seen in mainstream media, have great success as Aboriginal people.
I mean, people from overseas came here, like Gerry Adams, the former head of the IRA, Louis Farrakhan, you know, the black Muslim leader. I mean, a lot of people came to Redfern. It was like if you had any credibility and you're an international rock star or whatever, and you wanted to kind of get into contact with black Australia, you came to Redfern.
Yeah, you did. We've seen a lot of popular people coming down to the block. I remember there was Snoop Dogg back in the early 2000s. Mum always talks about the time she just missed meeting Michael Jackson because she was pregnant with my sister. So many of these people knew about the block, and we just felt so proud that we came from this community.
Like, as you mentioned, we're at Carriage Works here in your beautiful studio, which used to be a clothing store, I think. They made uniforms for the rail. We're in the Everleigh Rail Yards, but it's beautifully lit. The work that you've made for the Adelaide Biennial of Australian Art, it riffs on a theme of some work that was included in the Telstra Art Awards, which I wrote about. Tell me about your fascination with iron lace work. I mean, we're not talking about lace here, we're talking about iron, a prefabricated iron lace work, like you might see on a heritage building.
Well, I lived in about 5 terrace homes down in the block. Mum had lived with Nan. My dad lived with his parents just across the street. So there was many houses I could go to, and all the mob was down there too. I could go to my cousins. But we lived across each other's homes. 5 of them I can remember very distinct cast iron panels on the verandas of these houses. And it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago when I started thinking about memory and thinking about my times growing up in Redfern, and I remember just seeing these cast iron objects coming into my mind, and I was so fascinated by it, and I started to question what these objects are, because they are a fragment of memory, and it's a fragment, but it's an object that we have touched every day. We've gone past and we've gone, you know, exit and entered our homes. I became really interested in the objects, that they were something that was almost invisible to us as we just lived in these homes. We didn't really think or consider what they are, where the designs actually came from. But it's understanding what these objects are, is that an artist reproduced this. An artist had thought of a design that they could have to represent place, or have a design that talks about certain themes. And that's what I became really interested in trying to discover and understand how they function in an urban space, and how they function as these Western objects in an Aboriginal community, and what that means, and how does that memory of the Aboriginal experience carry on by understanding what these objects are. And I started to then question what these objects are in relation to our bodies, in relation to our experiences and memories, is that these are processes of colonialism.
I don't know where you get them, but these are there's originals here. They're really heavy. Where do you buy it, on eBay?
Yeah, no, I actually went to Leichhardt, so Leichhardt has this little terrace house factory. So you can go into the backyard and find all...
When you're renovating your terrace that you own for $15 million.
Yes, go find the Leichhardt terrace factory. But, you know, it's so nice how they, you know, assemble all these old objects that have been removed from houses and just chucked into the ground. But they assemble them in a way that they try to categorize what the motifs are in the symbolism within the fences as well. So here we can see other florals that are in one fence, and this fence was also a replica of the one that my grandmother lived in down at the block at the bottom, which is number 35 Everly Street. So I remember this fence very, very strongly. And this other one.
Let's have a photographic memory. I mean, there's the detail in this iron lacework, I guess you looked at it every day.
Yeah, we've seen it all day. And I remember as a kid, I took a lot of attention to it because I seen the designs in it. And that's the time when, you know, mum just was encouraging me to make art and paint and get really into the work, you know. But I spent so much time as a kid with these fences too. Like Christmas time, I'd be the one on the balcony there putting Christmas lights on them. And it was just a fun little memory.
I grew up in country New South Wales, so around between heads, coastal country New South Wales. We never saw iron lacework. We never saw terrace houses. When I came to Sydney and I first saw the terrace houses in Glebe and Redfern in the inner city of Sydney, I was just like, I mean, these people must be rich. Look at these mansions. They're like something out of a storybook. I was really captivated by them as well, by this. You know, it was very common, you know, in Sydney and Melbourne in the latter part of the 19th century, I suppose. But most people would look past them. You've got books about, you know, decorative cast iron in Australia, the history of decorative cast iron. So you've looked at every detail. What do you see when you look at them? I mean, do you see European visual traditions? I know you're trying to unpack that and kind of make this tradition something which was part of your life, part of your practice, yeah. Part of your work.
You know, the last few years I've actually just been doing walks, you know, around the streets and trying to understand.
Casing joints.
No. It's been really
fun. If you see Dennis Golding walking past your house real slowly, your magnificent terrace house, don't. He's all right. He's an artist.
Yes, it's all right. I'm only looking at the fences, not anyone else.
Do you photograph them?
I do, yeah, which is a bit creepy. The questioning behind it as well is understanding what this fence could actually mean in this suburb. So I see this in Redfern. So then I start to think, is it a Redfern fence? And then when I go to Surry Hills, I see these other ones of the day lilies. And that's a European lily, a European motif. So I start to consider, is this now a Surry Hills fence? So it's trying to understand the categorisation of how these fences are placed into Sydney and are they considered by the demographic?
We're talking about decorative art here. These things were designed by someone. Someone sat down and drew the frieze, you know, the pattern across the top, the middle pattern, the lower section, and it had to work in with the balcony sometimes. They're very elaborate designs. But I guess we're talking about acanthus, lily, you know, European florals, I suppose. But what you've tried to do is in accepting that this was part of your life and part of your black experience in a city black experience, you sought to remake them as well. I mean, not only do you not exhibit the iron because you mould it and epoxy resin, it's much lighter, much more transportable, but you sought to remake these things and it's kind of led in other directions towards ceramics.
Well, as you said before, you know, someone sat down and actually came up with a good plan to design something and knew that this fence would be a very iconic feature for these terrace homes. And trying to understand, you know, that history and that making of a design as well is very interesting. And it's unknown who these artists are. And I wish, you know, through my research I could find the names of these people because they're such beautiful designs and they are considered of so much about home settings and what it means to actually own home or how to design your home. And so it's thinking about the architectural elements as well of what they mean and how they settle into a space and then become this representation of culture.
I mean, I had known you as a student at the College of Fine Arts, but I didn't really know much about your work. And then I saw this work, the final year exhibition. Just describe where this begins. It's a series of portraits, generally you, but you're wearing something.
Yeah. These photographs feature myself draped in a superhero cape. And that started back in art school when it was a couple of courses I took, but there was this one that really stuck to me. The course was called Painting Futures. And the task in the assessment in this course was about how do we present identity and culture in urban spaces and how can we establish new narratives. And so I started to think about memory and think about experience, but also post-human experiences of what's left behind or who do we become after human or how do we represent ourselves in the future. And I think, drawn from my own experiences as a child, I was really drawn to superheroes and comic book characters, and my favourite character was Batman. And I remember for my birthday down, I think it was my sixth or seventh birthday, we were down living in Redfern. Mum put on a little party for me with family around, and she got me the superhero costume, the Batman costume. And I remember as a kid feeling so strong when I put that cape on. There's something so beautiful but so powerful about that memory as well, that you put this object on and all of a sudden you change and you transform and you become something else. And so that's something that I thought was empowering and that I could present as a concept at art school, which then started the beginning of my career as an artist.
You talk about, you know, police were omnipresent in Redfern.
Yeah, this I think speaks so much about Aboriginal people's experience living in the city, particularly in Redfern, constantly being surveilled. And I remember as a kid myself, police cars just driving around, doing the rounds basically.
Because we're black, we're up to no good. We're doing something wrong, yeah. Even in our homes, our own homes.
Something every time, and something that is mysterious. Going back to that memory as a kid, you know, as Batman, the little young black Batman, trying to have fun with that too. Like I remember running behind cars when I'd see that police car and I'd just be in my own imagination thinking like I'm going to run away and thinking that I'm invisible. So I think that was so fun at the time, but I just was playing with that idea as a superhero. Yeah.
And I'm fascinated with Aboriginal comic superheroes. I'm fascinated with how Aboriginal people, we take up this idea of the superhero. In a way, and I think marginalised communities all over the world do.
I think when you understand the history of Redfern as well as the birthing place of black civil rights movements, there's something powerful about that. And that's something that continues to drive us and to be powerful. And I think as young black kids, you know, living within this community, seeing all these protests and, activations around our country that, you know, really talk about our mob, we want to imagine that we have a great power, and that's what's so relevant with comic book characters.
Do you ever like wear the capes around the house to feel more empowered?
Yeah, I do. I certainly do. And I remember back in art school, I'd walk around in shops and supermarkets everywhere wearing a cape.
No.
It's true. Yeah, I really wanted to experiment and actually play with how people actually see me wearing a cape as an adult.
Because the work that was here at Carriage Works and a collaboration with the school kids at Alexandria State Primary School, not far from here, a lot of black kids in that school, just on the edge of Redfern there. So you invited the kids to create their own capes and to think about the icon that represented culture and identity. So you provoked them and challenged them. What did they come up with?
That was the key challenge in the workshop, which was part of Solid Ground at Carriage Works. And they came up with so many different designs that talked about their memory and their experiences. So there was the goannas. And that animal is a very common totem, you know, on Wiradjuri country. And
Bundjalung totem as well.
And Bundjalung too. And actually, I'm not sure you saw Daniel, but they also had language in there, which one of them was Bundjalung.
I saw the word Yama, you know, yeah. Gamilaroi word.
Yep. Many other different language names referencing water and different words that spoke so much about how they talk today, which is deadly. There were all these different themes, though, that I could see that they were connecting to country in a way that they see memory and they see different motifs such as animals and so the birds, marine animals as well. These young people had this connection to place by different animals and different flowers, but also so resonated to the Aboriginal flag, which they painted in the shape of a love heart.
The work in the Adelaide Biennial, without giving too much away, You've imagined the iron lacework doing something completely different. I wasn't expecting it. A work called Casting Shadows. What have you done with that?
I really like the word cast because it's understanding what Aboriginal experiences of living in the block and living from country is that they are cast out. And there's this common, you know, process when making the objects is that you're casting the epoxy resin into this mould and then you remove it again. So there's this continuation of putting in and then removing. And I try to shift the function, you know, again, by removing its form as a placemaking or a barrier between people. So rather than the fence, having them presented in a very different way. In the form of a chandelier, that's how you can see shadows casting from these objects, that they don't actually function, you know, just as the material and looking at the material, but looking how they cast shadows is another component that I really wanted to expand because I hadn't worked with shadows before in previous work. So this is extending to that whole idea of what cast is and casting people in, casting people out, objects in, objects out, and shifting the function from what a fence actually does to people and how harmful that can be to people.
And just lastly, there's another section to the Adelaide Biennial, another work, which is ceramic. I mean, we were talking about photography and how you use photography. Photography is not the subject of your work. The interplay of light and shadow and colour, I mean, these are important documents that you've created of the CAPE series of works. But I guess the ceramic, you basically will do use anything or find the best technique to represent what you're trying to do. And you talk about storytelling being the core of what you do.
Rather than the form or sticking with one medium, I think the storytelling will find its way to the medium of what you need to do to present it. And I think understanding, you know, the cast iron objects, that they are designed from a different time. They're designed by someone from a very different, you know, far place from here. And there's this sense of heraldry of what is created within these fences. And I wanted to take on that experience of trying to find and, you know, discover these objects that and these motifs that reference my own experiences and memories. And so what you can see in this exhibition is a shield, a contemporary shield that I've made to actually present my memories and my experiences in, you know, the form of one of the fences from the settlement. Kolaronbri actually means place of many flowers in Kamilaroi language. And that's something that really drived this new shield, understanding that, you know, these Western objects have, European lilies and other flowers that talk about, you know, Western identity. Place of many flowers in Kolaronbri could be shared, showing this new identity or showing this, you know, existing and continuing culture.
So we had designs that represented clans and represented ownership and mob. And you're kind of, I guess, synthesizing heraldry, but turning it into something that you can recognize.
Yeah.
Colonizing it in a way. Yeah. I like this. Blackfellas colonizing stuff.
Colonizing stuff and reclaiming things. Yeah. You know, it's
I know it's a dirty word, colonizing, but
let's keep using it. Don't worry. You know, it's something that's just so powerful, though, you know, when we are using those terms and we are seeing these objects in a very contemporary way that talks about our history, but also talks about what we go through today as Aboriginal people.
Dennis Golding, and you can see his work in Free State, the Adelaide Biennial of Australian Art, curated by Sebastian Goldspink. That's it for The Art Show this week. Our producer is Rosa Ellen. Thanks to sound engineer Ari Gross. You can follow us on the ABC Listen app or find us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Daniel Browning. I'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.